You are listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I am your host, Celine Yeager. Each week, I bring you advice from athletes, scientists, researchers, and other experts to help you feel and perform your best, no matter what your hormones are doing. This show is a production of Live Feisty Media. Hello, strong, feisty women. I hope you all are well. So, as I'm recording this, I am fresh off of our Weighty Matters module of our new Navigate Menopause course. And boy, oh boy, did we really have what came down to a very large group therapy session with 100 other women last night, just talking about this weighty matter, you know, the body composition changes that happen during midlife and menopause. Because the body composition changes that happen are hard. They're hard for everyone. Some women more or less than others, but I don't know anyone who has just sailed through this and has been like, I'm perfectly happy with all of this. And, you know, women have a lot of questions, primarily surrounding weight loss. And I am always incredibly honest and forthright about this. Nobody has the answers. Every single one of our bodies is going to change with age and menopause. That's not to say that there aren't actions that we can take. We talk about those, including like fiber and protein and heavy lifting and, you know, planning your eating so you're fueled for your workouts, all of that, each and every week here. But it is to say that there's a reason that there are literally thousands of studies on weight gain and loss and maintenance and billions of dollars worth of books sold over the past decades, especially to midlife women, and that we are targets now in menopause, that everybody sees there's money to be made. There is no one answer, and it's hard. I have sat through session after session at, you know, obesity conferences and sports conferences and menopause society conferences and female athlete performance conferences. And if there was one answer, we would all know it. We'd all know it. We wouldn't have Ozempic. We wouldn't have all of this. So if you feel like you're alone, you're not. And if you feel like you don't know all the answers, it's because nobody does. So one of the things that I do try to do here is to help women understand the underlying factors, what's going on, and also maybe just to look at things a little differently, you know, just to take down the temperature on the conversation. Like maybe all weight gain is not quote unquote bad. You know, people sometimes get mad when I say this, but research, and I'll drop it in the show notes for this, research and lived experience shows that that's true. So it's been a bit since I've explored some of these concepts, and I know they're really top of many people's minds in this time of life. So I do like to come in every now and then, even though I don't like to talk about weight a ton, I do like to come in and just have a conversation about some of these issues with different experts. So I was really excited this week to sit down with dietitian Val Schoenberg. She is a midlife health and nutrition specialist who has studied metabolism at midlife and body composition changes and all of that. You know, that's her specialty. And I just really loved her insights into all of it. There's a lot to chew on here about women and how inherently strong and resilient our bodies are and how maybe we can appreciate them and all that they do for us, even as we work on them during this time. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. I will drop her information in the show notes if you want to learn more about her. She's at valschoenberg.com. She has a lot to offer and a lot of really, really great blogs herself. So I highly recommend checking her site out. All right, before we get to it, if you haven't yet, go to feistymenopause.com and sign up for my new Feisty 40 Plus newsletter. It is super fun. It includes a workout of the week from Dr. Carla DiGirolamo, who many people don't know. She's also a trainer. She worked part-time for Wild Health, and she's been involved in CrossFit Health forever. Features badass women from our community, lots of research and more. Totally digestible, really fun, totally free. So go there, click on the link, check it out, sign up. If you haven't already, also give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Feisty Menopause. Join our private Hit Play Not Pause Facebook group. And if you have questions for me, you can always click on that little SpeakPipe link in the show notes and leave me a voicemail message in our SpeakPipe voicemail box. Before we get to it, I just want to say that we have a couple of really nice reviews coming in from Prevenex's new product, Muscle Health Plus, which I really like. Allison says, it is a great product. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I noticed right away that I feel so much stronger during my early morning workouts when I take this. I'm really impressed. That's how I use it too, Allison. I put it in a shake, throw in a shot of espresso, and go do my weight workouts in the morning pretty early before 7 a.m. And it's been really great, and it helps me recover too. So thank you, Prevenex, for all of your longtime endless support, all of the help for our community. Really appreciate it. All right, that is truly enough of me. Let's have a few words about our awesome sponsors and get on with the show. Musculoskeletal health is everything during menopause. Everyone knows how much I love Joint Health Plus from Prevenex, which has helped me get back to distance running after arthritic toes stopped me in my tracks. Now they have a product that has become my go-to for muscle strength and recovery, Muscle Health Plus. Muscle Health Plus contains all the key ingredients we talk about on this show, like creatine monohydrate, essential amino acids, and branched-chain amino acids, plus even more cutting-edge ingredients like HMB and estrogen that are scientifically shown to increase muscle growth, recovery, and strength. I use it every day during my early morning lifting sessions, and there's no question that it helps my power during those workouts and my recovery after. Plus, I love having everything I need from the best high-quality ingredients in one reasonably priced shake. I've also heard from fellow users who have had bloating or GI upset in the past from creatine that haven't had any of that with Muscle Health Plus. I make my shake with almond milk and espresso, but it's also good with ice cold water, which makes the flavor really pop. As always, you can get 15% off your first order with the code HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. That's HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. Do your muscles a favor and head on over and get some today. All right, Val, I am, this is a topic so near and dear to my heart on so many levels, and I was very excited when I just sort of stumbled across some of your writing on the internet, because I thought, this is really a woman who aligns with a lot of my thinking in many levels about this topic, about weight and body composition changes and metabolism and all of that. So I appreciate you being here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for our conversation.
Let's start sharing a bit about you, because all I know is what I read, but I see that you have worked as a dietitian for about 2 decades. You know, how did you get started, and have you seen your practice evolve as you yourself have entered midlife?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my clinical background as a dietitian started in working with eating disorders. So I worked in all levels of care of eating disorder with all different ages, all different types of eating disorders. And it was during a time that I was specializing in binge eating disorder and led a binge eating disorder intensive outpatient program that I started seeing and working more with midlife women. And as they were working through their recovery and even, you know, well into their recovery from their eating disorder, we were, you know, continuing to have stabilized nutrition patterns and all of that. But what they started to kind of be stressed about was some of the changes that were coming along with menopause. So this was around 2012, 2013 for me. And I was similarly having, you know, some of the similar signs and symptoms. And so I was also really curious, like, you know, why is there this belly fat? Why are they not losing weight now that they're not binge eating anymore? They've added in activity and they're still, you know, having these signs and symptoms or even hot flashes and things. And I didn't know anything about it. And so all I was really trying to do was find like a good book or a doctor or something online or just something to give them some information. And every time someone would say, like a colleague would say, you should read this book. And I would get the book and I would start reading it. And I'm like, really? Like, why would we take out fruit? Like, I don't understand. You know,
Yes.
or what is this? What is it that, you'd hear on one hand it's estrogen dominance, and then on the other hand, it's that we don't have any estrogen. And I'm like, well, those are two opposing viewpoints. And plus, you have to remember, I was very aware of the eating disorder literature when you look at hormones and all of and weight and physiology with even anorexia nervosa or female athlete triad or now REDS. And so I knew all of that research, and it just was really messing with me. So I describe it as kind of being like pulling on a sweater, like a loose string, and it just started to unravel. So by 2015, I was really immersed in the menopause literature and became aware of the North American Menopause Society. So I became just did a lot of research, learning, went to their conferences, and became certified as a menopause practitioner. And I personally found the information really, really helpful for my own signs and symptoms because it was reassuring that I wasn't crazy or that something bad wasn't happening to my body. And when I had, 30 days of bleeding, sorry, TMI, but
Oh
hopefully
yeah, we've all
your
told. We've
listeners,
said so many things more than that. Go
I
ahead.
mean, I didn't like, completely have this intense reaction to the signs and symptoms. And to this day, which I'm finally postmenopausal, I think, I've been one of those late perimenopausal people. And so I've gone through probably 10 years of symptoms, and it's been really interesting to have that experience, but also be immersed in understanding what we know and what we don't know. And I think it's being calm about, well, they don't really know for sure, so I guess we'll just be okay with it. Whereas many women, again, they're kind of on this wild goose chase to find the right answer or the right thing to eat or that something's wrong with them because the mainstream media is really playing into that narrative. And that's where I'm really passionate about getting better information out to women.
And I appreciate that. And I also appreciate the acknowledgement that maybe we just don't know everything, you know? And before I hit record, you and I talked about that, but one of the things that I really loved, you wrote a blog called The Weight of Menopause. And I'll just read the sentence. It says, "Here I am after years of being completely immersed in the research, and I can honestly say that I don't believe clinicians really understand why women gain weight and certainly aren't investigating whether weight gain or weight redistribution may play a protective role in aging," which I have actually had a podcast on and written about myself. But I felt like this was like such a refreshing sentence, such a refreshing viewpoint. My community is filled with women who have years, if not decades, of training logs. They haven't suddenly become less active. They haven't radically changed stuff. And I'd love to talk about some of the drivers behind body composition changes, both hormone and age related. And what do you think we know and what don't we know?
I mean, starting from the hormone side of things, again, back to that narrative that it's, well, we've depleted estrogen and so we're all gaining weight.
Right.
Well, if that were true, then when we look at functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, which is also a state, a hypoestrogenic state, which can be brought on by stress, it can be brought on by low energy availability, which you might see with anorexia nervosa or just overexercising. I mean, there's so many conditions that can subject someone to hypoestrogen conditions, and we don't see the same thing. Now, is it an age thing? I don't know that that's true. I think that when you look at the more emerging research, which is interesting, is certain labs are starting to look at animal models of what is the influence of increasing follicle stimulating hormone. Right? Now that's going to be opposite of what you would see in an FHA situation where follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are low because the origin of the amenorrhea is coming from the brain versus with menopause, it's coming from our ovaries. Like we're all at eggs, don't really need to be, producing that. The other interesting part of that, though, that kind of doesn't really put the nail in the coffin that it's all about estrogen is when you think about the studies that show perimenopause, myself being probably a testament to that as well, of where there's really, really high levels of estrogen, right? Like higher than premenopausal levels. So that doesn't make sense, like, because many women are experiencing these changes in body composition during those perimenopausal years. And in postmenopause, often we see the weight potentially stabilize And if you look at trajectories of weight change in aging, generally after age 65, there's more concern about weight loss, right? Like for a whole bunch of reasons that are kind of separate from hormones. So I don't think we can really say it's all hormones. Clearly, hormones seem to have a role when you think about body fat redistribution. There's some reason that the body wants to store fat in the abdomen rather than a subcutaneous fat, which is just a difference. Why that is, and if someone's aware of exactly the reason, please share it with me. But I haven't seen a very clear theory or longitudinal study that says exactly what the change is. Because if we gave hormone therapy, right? Like if we did menopause hormone therapy, then technically it should correct it. And that doesn't necessarily do that. It might attenuate or decrease the fat redistribution, but eventually it kind of comes back up to, say, someone who didn't use menopause hormone therapy.
Yeah, I've seen that literature too. And I mean, it does seem clear that there is a hormonal connection to the muscle loss that we see. That the
Right.
yeah.
Absolutely. So then if you look at the exercise physiology literature, it might be like a little bit of a perfect storm, right? So, yes, there's the changing hormones where estrogen has a protective role in the muscle, but then there's also a natural loss of lean tissue, which happens in all humans. So, even in the male physiology, we're going to see that natural loss of lean tissue. And people always think about that as just your skeletal muscle that you can see, but it's also our organs, which are our very metabolically active tissue. So the heart tissue, the liver, all of those kinds of things. And then the other thing that I often talk about in all of that is, your history of dieting. So if you have a history of restrictive eating, whether it's intentional or just unintentionally, you were super busy and you just don't have a very hungry brain and you never really ate very much or whatever, and you haven't really deposited a good amount of lean tissue, or you've lost that lean tissue because of weight loss. And then when you gain the weight back, you're gaining probably more adipose tissue or fat back. And then as we get older, we have anabolic resistance. So that ability to build muscle is just not as easy. It's not that we can't, and there's great studies that show the importance of that. It's just that it's a little bit harder. So I think that's why we see so many nuances between women, and we can't have these generalizations and generic advice about, well, just go do this and then you'll fix your body composition. It's probably going to be a little bit more individualized than that.
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing that up. The especially in this, and I hope it's changing. But we really grew up in heavy diet culture, right? Like it was very, very prominent. And you do see a lot of women, even very active women, who have weight cycled. And in my endurance sport, you'd see that all the time. You would see people drastically have a different off-season weight than they would have in a competition, cycle sort of weight. And the idea that that might eventually, quote unquote, catch up to you is intriguing to me, because you do, it's hard to lose weight without losing some muscle, right? And there's a cumulative effect, and then all of a sudden you lose more, at this sort of perfect storm time. When I did a show on Ozempic a few weeks ago, the doctor was very clear about that. She's like, that is the concern, because you can't lose, especially if you lose it quickly, you can't do that without losing muscle, and you don't almost ever gain it back as muscle when you have some regain, which
Yeah,
seems
there's
to
a
set up a
lot
vicious
to
cycle.
unravel with that. I would also say, I have a lived experience of going through that as well. So I've been lifting weights since I was in my 20s, and I've always been active. And I went through a time period of, falling victim to the woes of the Atkins diet and all that stuff back from the 80s and all that. And then at a point where I actually went through a divorce, which made me extremely depressed, and I did not work out. And I gained a lot of weight, like very uncomfortable, went through that. And more than really would have been like my set point, if you will. So it like was this overshoot, which I didn't understand any of this at that time. This was over 25 years ago. And now looking back, it was, basically a diet cycle. And when I, gave my body better nutrition and wasn't exercising, my body very protectively took care of itself, for another famine that was going to come on. Now, in my story, I got back into like really good nutrition as well as exercise, started lifting again, started, just a really great relationship with exercise in that, and still to this day. And then my body kind of stabilized where its DNA wants to be at. And so, and I even have seen in my own like journals where it's like, boy, why can't I lose this weight? Right? Like I wasn't overeating, right? It was like not eating a lot of calories by any standard. And there is, that's again, that would be my lived experience. That's, some of what we see in the research, but also just to recognize that some of that may be a protective part of our body, right? Like it doesn't know that we're safe and okay. The body has sensed there's been a stress, there's been a harm. Let's make sure that we can, continue to live. So those are some of the kind of things that I think we need to research and understand better and talk about that, there's nothing wrong with someone dieting or trying to, or, maybe they have a, they've lost weight. We certainly don't want to stigmatize that. But to be a little more compassionate or gentle with the recovery process to what your healthy biological weight might need to be at any given stage of your life, I think is where we need to do a better job.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that. And I did a show early on with another woman who was a sort of a global dietitian, and she talked about how her thinking was that some of the weight gain around midlife and menopause is protective. You know, she said it does make a weaker form of estrogen. It does make estrogen, you know, and if you look at some of the research, it doesn't bear out that you're all of a sudden at this higher risk for all these things. You know, I mean, I think we need to tease out health versus perception versus what we just like and don't like and what we've been told to like and don't like. What are your thoughts around like the protective elements that might be happening around this time?
Well, a couple things. So one, there is a 2001 study. Of course, I've had interns myself. We've tried to find more recent data, but there's just this one particular study, which was really interesting. Large group of people, Seventh Day Adventist study from 2001. And what they found, they followed these people over a 22-year period, I believe. Or it was 17, I might have the numbers mixed up, but they followed them for a, it's a very long longitudinal study. And what they found was for women who gained, I believe on average, that might be where it was like either on average they gained 17 pounds or 22 pounds over that time period,
This is ringing bells.
they, yep, and they had a threefold decrease in mortality risk, largely related to the cardioprotective effect of that weight gain. And the authors theorized that it is because of this production of estrone, which is that, other form of estrogen, that again, that visceral body fat is where that aromatization of that, those androgens can come from to produce that protective effect. And so that suggests that now that study also showed that it's not saying that you gain weight to healthy levels, whatever that might even mean.
Right.
But for some people, there might be that shift in weight that it is super protective and definitely for more of a lean person. So that's what that study said. Another study that I have that's really interesting is where they did body composition analysis on a group of women between the ages of 18 and 70, and they were all elite athletes. So they were endurance athletes, swimmers, runners, and triathletes, and they were all competing at their respective levels. So collegiate level of sports or local or national competitions. And they looked at their body composition. And among these athletes, these women athletes, there really was no difference in their weight or body fat or even lean tissue. So they didn't see in the older women where they had this decrease in lean tissue. But what they did see is, a natural decrease in VO2 max. But when compared to the sedentary controls, certainly not what we would see in a sedentary individual. But the increase in that intra-abdominal adipose tissue that they measured was markedly higher in the 45 plus group. So even though these are active women that really weren't experiencing a change in their body weight on a scale, perhaps, they were still having some of this intra-abdominal body fat. And so again, it just begs the question of, well, why would that be? And they didn't talk about their diet or nutrition or did they do other cross training or anything like that. So those are examples of where I think we can see in research that the message of, well, we need to do everything to not gain weight, prevent weight gain, definitely don't gain any visceral body fat, and then people are going and doing these DEXA-fit things and all these different tests. It's really causing more stress for people that is probably unnecessary. And if we could just really address the maybe body dissatisfaction, like if you're feeling really uncomfortable in your changing body, there's really great ways we can address that. Or if you're really concerned about your health risk, well, we can do some education around that to say, yep, we don't understand why your body is changing, but these are the things that you can do to reduce your risk of heart disease or diabetes, or if you're concerned about some of those different things because of family history or just your own, genetic profile.
Yeah, no, those are great points. And you see it across the globe, throughout time. I mean, this is just like it's a phenomenon. It's not unique, it's not new.
Oh,
It
I
is.
love it. Yeah, I love it that you say that because here, that's what I always, when I'm reading some of this, my brain goes to, because there'll be all of these things about how horrible it is when we're going through menopause. I mean, it's amazing we actually stay alive. And so that circles me back into that whole story of the grandmother hypothesis, which is, well, why do we outlive our reproductive years? What is it? And certainly, even though women have certainly been dismissed in research over many, many decades, we still outlive our male counterparts to a
Yep.
great extent.
That's a
And
good
so
point.
I don't
Despite
think
all that,
that,
we still
despite all that
outlive
research and all that horrible thing, somehow we live a long time. And some of that is medical, technology, of course, but over, centuries, our body has this really important ability to live a longer time. And if you think about the grandmother hypothesis, this is where it becomes a little Pollyanna, but it is that part of where we have an important role as women, And so that's where I, kind of wave my, red flag to women to say, don't get too mired down into your distress about your body composition. Let's get you some help because we have a really important role for our younger women, our daughters, our granddaughters, our nieces, just other people that, can see us not anxious or worried or trying to fix and shrink our bodies. I think there can be a really important role that we serve in terms of all this wisdom and just trusting that we really do have the capability to live a long time, even if you do experience some of that weight gain. Let's help you feel better in your body. Let's help you have some less stress about that. And there's certainly important ways to go about doing that.
And there's ways if you are, and I say this all the time, if you are concerned, there are many ways to measure your cardiovascular wellness and health. I mean, we have blood panels, we have calcium artery scans if you want to go that far, but like there are ways to look at it and there's many modalities to take care of it. So, yeah.
I 100% agree. That's kind of where I go with the insulin resistance story, where that's been, the more recent thing over the last couple of years as well. Now we all have insulin resistance, and that's why we've gained all this weight. And it's like, okay, so yes, estrogen has this protective role in helping cells be sensitive to insulin. So it makes sense from animal models or what you might theorize that if we don't have estrogen, then we're going to maybe be more resistant to insulin. But if you look at studies on people. That isn't necessarily what happens. And my other point to that is you can go test that and measure that. You can track your triglycerides. You can look at your A1C. You can look at your fasting blood glucose. And then if there is a concern, well, then let's address that and treat that. But to just randomly assume you need to cut out carbohydrates or do some of these interventions that people talk about because you must have insulin resistance, that just is crazy making. And really unfortunate because carbohydrates, probably are one of the more important things in terms of our vitality and aging when you think about fiber and frankly just enjoying food and having some pleasure. But we don't need to be cutting out all these foods that people have been told to cut out.
Yeah, I would like to broadcast that into space. Speaking, you didn't go there, but you sort of skirted around my next question, which is another thing that we hear, and it's speaking of crazy making, this has gone into crazy making territory, cortisol. Please, I will just give you the floor. Like, what talk about like the role here that it plays and what you're thinking and how other people should think about cortisol at this time of life.
I mean, I think if we look at it objectively, if someone's concerned about their cortisol, what I have seen in the research is that yes, there can be this natural increase in cortisol as we go through, especially those late perimenopausal years, and that might play a role in some of the disruptive sleep that we all experience. But what are you going to do about it? Right. So some of it can be the hormone fluctuations that are shifting and changing. And until things kind of stabilize and the brain picks up on that, because my understanding is more into the postmenopausal years, a lot of this just stabilizes out, which is for some of us postmenopausal people, will experience less anxiety, more peace and calm. More stepping into this place of just feeling really strong and wise, and you don't really care about what anyone thinks. But so, if that's the reason that there's a shift, then we just need to probably write it out. If it's probably more likely, though, this perfect storm of this stage of life is really stressful. Right? There's a lot of stressful things going on, or we're making up psychologically stories in our mind that we're being chased by a bear,
I'm good at
basically.
that.
Red? Oh, me too. And so it's noticing, like, let's say that you have someone who tests your cortisol and they say, oh, you've got high cortisol. Okay. Well, unless it's really like Cushing's disease or some like really, treatable condition, even this idea that your adrenals are just worn out and exhausted, well, that's been debunked. That's actually not a true story. But if you are concerned about your cortisol, then we have to look at what might be underlying that. Besides hormones, which you might go on menopause hormone therapy, that might be an option to consider. But the other thing might be, what do you need to do in terms of learning diaphragmatic breathing or meditation or accessing some spiritual grounding behaviors? Maybe you need to look at relationships that are not super helpful in your life, or you need to evaluate your work situation. Maybe it's that you're under-eating and over-exercising, and your body senses stress from that condition, and you need to get that in better balance. All of those could be potential reasons for what is causing that. And what I will add to this is Dr. Christi Shufelt, I think her name is Christina Shufelt. She's out of Mayo, and she just has been doing some more recent research with functional hypothalamic amenorrhea and comparing it to postmenopausal women. And a study that came out at the end of last year, she actually talked about this, I think, 2 years ago at the North American Menopause
I was
Society
there.
conference. I don't know if you were there, but she has in her research where she's shown with these younger FHA, amenorrhea women that their insulin is low, but their cortisol is high. And compared to the postmenopausal women, their cortisol isn't high. So there's that condition of stress that comes from Like in that situation, is it the stress induced, or is it the imbalance of, low estrogen? They haven't really tapped into that. They're looking at endothelial dysfunction and they're looking at it from a cardiovascular health standpoint. But we can say that, okay, younger people have elevated cortisol as well in an amenorrheic state. And exactly what is that about? And then what's the intervention going to be? Because if you think that you've got to cut out a food or you need to lose weight or there's something like that, you're probably going to contribute to the problem.
Right. Yeah, I know that, and cut all the carbohydrates out of your diet and all of that. Yeah, you probably will. And can you please just say for the record that cortisol does not turn into fat?
If it does, someone needs to show me the data that that happens. I mean, that's just not how fat metabolism happens. So that's interesting. Is that something you've heard?
I've seen it. I have seen it. And I'm like, that's not, I think where that comes from is that the broader notion that cortisol encourages maybe fat storage, like, but it doesn't just mechanistically turn into fat. Like, that's not a thing.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, I have never seen that physiology anywhere.
That's good. Yeah. Well, maybe you should spend more time on Instagram and,
Okay, well, that to that point though, right? Like I'm very aware that when I'm on social media, my heart starts racing. I don't know why. Like, I mean, I try to be really careful about my algorithm and, make sure I'm seeing pleasant things, but that's not always possible. And I do think there's something about just the medium. And so that's where people have to recognize, like, are you spending too much time on social media and getting all these reels and getting all this like really scary stories that is messing with you? Well, that in and of itself is going to drive up your cortisol. Like you're because you're now your heart's starting to race, and your heart doesn't and your body doesn't know. Again, when you think of the stress response, which is really simplistically our body's way of getting us back to homeostasis, and homeostasis is where, our blood pressure is balanced, our blood glucose is, where it's supposed to be. Our t body temperature is where it's supposed to be. And anytime there's an outside influence that disrupts that homeostasis, well, adrenaline picks up, blood pressure picks up, all these things happen. Be but if you're making the story up in your mind or it's something you're reading on the screen, well, still our evolutionary standpoint doesn't know that we're not being chased by a lion. So we're having the same reaction. So digestion shuts down, the immune system, actually in a, a fight or flight response actually will pick up. But the long-term chronic effect of that, if that's related to, maybe a change in body composition, I don't think that's completely out of the question, but there are plenty of people who are really stressed that are quite lean and not gaining weight. So I don't know that that's the whole story. Right, that cortisol is the reason someone's gaining weight, however you want to spin the tale.
Right. No, it's an interesting. I mean, I think that there's that connection between cortisol and blood sugar, and I think that's where people follow that train down the line. And there's been, I mean, I was writing for prevention magazines in the 90s, and people were talking about cortisol and belly fat,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, what I go back to, even if you look at Dr. Shufeldt's that particular study, these are people who aren't necessarily gaining weight that have high cortisol.
Right.
So, or anorexia is another example where we're going to see elevated cortisol because the body is in a stressed condition. It is starving. It doesn't have adequate resources to be in homeostasis. We don't just necessarily see someone randomly gaining fat because, and people don't understand with anorexia nervosa, many people eat much more than you think. It's just that they're undernourishing their body chronically. And based on their metabolism or some other factors, they are sustaining a very low body weight for what their biology would be more healthy at.
So you're saying it's complex.
I think it's really complex and it often gets simplified. And then, even if you do think cortisol is what's causing your belly fat, my question would be, what are you going to do about it?
Yep.
It always comes back to, even if we don't, sometimes we're like, why is this happening? And the weight gain is another one. Like, why am I gaining weight? I want to lose weight. Okay, well, let's create a safe space to like explore that. And what are we going to do? Because you have to have a sense of getting back control. If you, because part of this is feeling out of control. My
Right,
body's out of
100%.
control.
100%.
I'm out of control. Life is out of control. And so it's let's take a breath. Let's come back to what can we do to care for our body, be kind to our body, nourish our body, and live your best life. Like what really matters most to you at this stage of life, too.
Good sleep. The one thing that sets you up for a great workout and a good day is quality sleep. We talk about it all the time here on the show, which is why I'm stoked to have Lagoon Sleep as a new sponsor. Because one of the most overlooked tools in a great sleep toolbox is the thing you literally rest your head on 8 hours a night, your pillow. A quality pillow is everything. Otherwise, you end up tossing, turning, punching, and folding your pillow, waking up with neck pain, and all the stuff that happens when your pillow doesn't meet your personal comfort needs. Say hello to the most comfortable sleep you've ever had with Lagoon. They start you out with a 2-minute personalized pillow quiz and then pair you with your perfect pillow. I got the Otter, a cooling adjustable pillow that is perfect for side sleepers who run warm at night like I do. It is a dream. It's fully adjustable, so I was able to get the perfect loft and support, and the cooling feature is everything. As someone who turned into a furnace every evening before menopause, I appreciate that the Otter is stuffed with shredded gel-infused memory foam, which instead of trapping heat from my neck and head, draws it away and dissipates it. It's truly delightful. I'm a good sleeper, and Otter has taken it to the next level with both support and cooling. Put my head down, good night, Irene. My Oura Ring confirms what little tossing and turning I was doing is gone. The beauty of the pillow quiz is you can get the perfect pillow that you need too and make your sleep the best sleep you can have. Go to lagoonsleep.com/hitplay and take the 2-minute quiz to find your perfect match, and then use the code HITPLAY, all caps one word, for 15% off your first purchase. Sweet dreams. For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are stoked to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas has unlocked the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research and creates better shoes for women's performance. Some of Hedas' special features include a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing on women's ankle bones, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and accommodate female toe shape, a more narrow and reductive heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take pressure off the Achilles, a rounded instep that creates a snug fit through the middle to match the curvature of a woman's foot, and supercritical foam and a PVEX plate in the midsole to keep our legs going when the going gets tough. Hedas has three shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for your long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've been running in the Alma Tempos, and they are a pleasure to train in. You can get your own pair of Hedas at hedas.com and use the code FEISTY20, that's all caps, FEISTY20, for 20% off. Check it out today. We'll put a clickable link in the show notes to make it a snap. Well, let's explore that just a little bit since we've opened that door. I mean, what are some of the best practices for women working? Because the physiology is changing in midlife and with menopause. And we did talk about resistance training, which we talk about all the time on the show, which is important. You know, I'm also curious on your thoughts on nutritional applications here. You know, increasing fiber came up, you know, as well, like what things that we can do to really work with if we indeed are like experiencing a bit more of the carbohydrate sensitivity or a bit more of the cortisol. Like, you know, how can we work with that? How can we work with our body to optimize ourselves?
Well, I think, bring it back to yourself first and foremost. So I always say test versus guess. So in the situation of, let's say someone does have a rising A1C, which is a measure of blood sugars over, say, 90 days. And for whatever reason, that's happening. Maybe you even have increased LDL cholesterol. And so these
A
are
lot of women do.
happening. And yes, well, and that's the other thing. Like in some cases, that's somewhat common. And do you need to treat it or not? And so that's really looking at What do we need to do? So let's say that LDL cholesterol is increasing, total cholesterol is increasing, A1C happens to be right at that threshold of going into prediabetes or something like that. Okay, well then let's look at what's going on with your diet. Like, what's your dietary pattern? Are you eating regularly, or are you skipping breakfast, skimping on lunch, and then catching up later in the day? Well, let's work on balancing that skewed intake. Let's look at what are some of the foods that you're eating. Are you avoiding a bunch of food? So then you don't have adequate sources of protein because you followed some very much vegan-oriented plant-forward diet, which isn't a bad idea, but oftentimes it's kind of a setup for under-eating and not getting enough protein. So we see some of those diets. So based on that particular individual, balancing out your intake, simplifying it to we've got breakfast, lunch, dinner, what snacks, are you working out? Like, I'm a huge fan of resistance training as well. And I would hope that, people can figure out an opportunity to learn how to do weight-bearing exercise, but mostly making it something you can enjoy. Many people don't have access. They don't want to do that type of weight training. Okay, great. Well, then you can still go walking. You could still paint a room and get up and down off a ladder. You could clean your floors with, like called a functional exercise. So looking at that, what are you willing to do? What can you do from a fitness standpoint and moving your body standpoint? And then what are those nutritional strategies that make the most sense for you? And the reason, like, sometimes we can fall into the diet culture trap when we start talking about fiber, right? And I've seen some stories of people talking about, oh, more is better. So then let's have 150 grams of fiber a day. And it's like, okay, so let's reel this back in and go back to the best research we have around fiber would say that the most benefit you or that you can get benefit at 25 grams of fiber per day. For women, let's just say it's 25 to 30 grams of fiber per day. That isn't hard to do. Like, you can have a peanut butter sandwich and a pear and have 10 grams of fiber, right? Like, nice couple slices of whole grain bread, good old peanut butter, maybe a banana, and or something. I mean, so it's things like that. It doesn't have to be this really complicated meal plan. And I think sometimes what we've done, especially in social media or Instagram, is we've made some of this look really hard. And then people throw up their hands. Or they see, recently, kind of one of the documentaries that came out that makes it sound like all food is bad. This food's going to kill you. You shouldn't have that food. Some of the stories that come out about, plant foods, whether it's organic or not organic or GMO. I mean, those are kind of the old, I don't think we hear that as much, right? That used to be the big thing we had to debunk. But then there's something else. It's something about lectins, or I mean, it's never ending. And so, we have to come back to, first of all, what do you need for your foundational nutrition? Let's balance out those nutritional sources. Let's probably have to manage some food rules or food beliefs that you have that aren't serving you well so that food and eating can be a little bit easier. Because like the peanut butter sandwich example, like where you're really busy, you don't have time to make something that maybe you think would be better if we want to think of it that way. So then what they do, someone might do is not eat, right? Like, I don't have time to do what I think I quote unquote should. So then, well, we'll just skip it and we'll come back to it. And then now we're running around in a fasting mode, and then we're ending up, overly hungry, and then it's this vicious cycle. Versus, make a quick sandwich. But it's gonna be hard to make a quick sandwich if you think bread is really bad for you, and that's gonna be the reason you're gonna have increased cortisol and then increased insulin and then all this fat gain. And that's what I think is spinning around in some people's heads.
Yeah, 100%. And I, I've seen some of that in my own self, when I was sort of like falling into the like, oh, maybe I should cut down on my carbs. And, during that whole time when everybody was like really in the beginning of demonizing carbs, but like nothing was worse for my blood sugar than that, than training and doing all the things I was doing without adequate carbohydrates. Like once I added those back in, everything got better.
And then we have to think of it like a pendulum, right? So if it's I shouldn't have any carbohydrates, then I think sometimes what people hear when we talk about like no carbohydrates are okay, it's that let's just swing the pendulum to the other side. And then, because carbs can certainly be highly palatable, and then, it might be easy to overdo that as well. And what does that really mean for that individual? And so, really, when we talk about where's that sweet spot in the middle where you have this balance of nourishing your body, but also pleasure with food, and you can feel a sense of kind of that balance that I think is easier said than done to achieve. But this is kind of where the idea of intuitive eating comes into play, right? Can you tune into your body? Can you pay attention? Now, if many of your listeners are active and do
They're
a
all
lot of
active.
exercise, I know for me, like some of that is going to work two different ways. Sometimes that extra activity drives up hunger, right? Like where your appetite is maybe higher than because of the intense exercise you're doing. And for other brains, it's the opposite, where you don't have any hunger. Like it shuts down because of that activity. So then I'll always say, well, if your hunger cues aren't super reliable, then you can intuitively know maybe what you need to do, like paying attention to some of the good, recommendations that are out there around just kind of make sure you're including some protein at each of those meals. Balance that out with, carbohydrates that would be some whole grains or different kinds of grains and fruits and vegetables and, some different fats and then move on. And, so again, I think that's where it becomes pretty individualized in terms of what that person is wrestling with to figure out what is that amount that's good for you. But if we go down the rabbit trail of, no sugar, no added sugars, those kinds of ideas. That seems to be helpful for some people at first. And then, we're kind of just back into that probably backfiring. So I'm not a big fan of, exclusions, but at the same time, we can, I guess you would use the word of gentle nutrition. You can find, kind of that balance between, nourishing your body well, but then also enjoying some fun foods here and there too.
Yeah, 100% agree. Let's pivot a little bit to metabolism because that sort of falls into some of what we've been talking about, and it's one of those,
Sure.
oh my Lord. I mean, talk about the headlines of all the magazines for decades, right? Master your metabolism. Really misunderstood. You wrote a really great piece about it. I've written about it. Can you just give a 10,000 foot overview of like what actually is metabolism and how people should think about it?
Yeah. Well, I love studying metabolism. I mean, I had a whole graduate class on it, and so when I think of metabolism, I think of that super complicated, graphic of all of the complex chemical reactions that happen in terms of within our cells. And we had to write that down 500 times and memorize it, right? And so basically it's what our body does to convert all the food and drinks and things that we consume into usable energy. And there's different pathways and different ways that our body does that. And it's important. It's that energy is used for fueling everything in our body, all those essential body functions, your immune system, digestion, reproduction, if you are in a reproductive frame of your lifespan, your bone health, your brain, your hormones, sleep-wake cycle, all of those different things are fueled because of that metabolism, right? So it's like kind of thinking about the engine in your car, if you want to think about that in all of your cells. So when I hear someone say, well, our metabolism is broken, our metabolism is slowing down, or some of that kind of stuff, I'm like, what does that mean? Right? Because in some ways, okay, well, we don't need a lot of energy to do reproduction anymore, but we still need to do digestion and we still need our immune system to function. And in fact, I talk about this in my blog, but there was a study that came out in 2021
I
that
covered
kind
it.
of,
Really
yeah,
interesting.
like contradicted what we believed. Like it really showed that, all the way up until age 60, there really isn't this huge shift, that we might measure or pay attention to. And even if you did use like a Harris-Benedict equation, or frankly, I've done a lot with indirect calorimetry with individuals, and so that's another example. So when I worked in residential treatment, we had a study that we were doing where we measured using indirect calorimetry, resting metabolic rate for individuals who mostly had anorexia nervosa in residential treatment. And we did it exactly the way you're supposed to. First thing in the morning, in a rested state, very calm. And from that real experience that I got to see, it really didn't match up with what you would predict, right? Like these were individuals that oftentimes their metabolism that we would measure was pretty close to what we would predict with, say, an equation. But many times it would be really, really high, right? And these are individuals who aren't eating, well, now they're eating more. Right. So you would predict that to be lower because they've restricted their calorie intake for such a long period of time. But it doesn't really, or we would be fueling them, right? Because it was all meals are provided at a level that they should be gaining at least 2 pounds per week. And we would have individuals that aren't gaining any weight. And we see that with cancer. We see that in other areas where there's like a hypermetabolic state. And so I think metabolism is very complicated and complex. And when it gets dumbed down to something like, well, it's just slowing down. And so, there's a popular diet ad right now that your metabolism is slowing and this is why we're all gaining weight. And so we have a perfect diet intervention for you. That's really misleading. And it sets up this idea that it's something you need to fix. That something's wrong with you, that something's broken. The other thing that I hear, and this is what kind of prompted me to write the metabolism blog, was that I actually hear this from dietitians who work in eating disorders who will reach out to me and say, okay, so my metabolism is slowing down, something's changing, I need to meet with you and we need to fix this. And I'm like, wow, I don't know, did you not have the same energy metabolism class that I had? But I think it gets at what are we really worried about? So at the end of the day, what this really is about is that we're somehow afraid of gaining weight. And I don't say that lightly. I totally get it, right? Like we're immersed in this culture that has us scared to death for a whole bunch of different reasons, that something about experiencing some weight shifting or some weight gain or just aging as a whole is this bad thing. And you can and should do everything to prevent it or battle it. I think metabolism gets wrapped up in that. And so that's really where I would say let your body be your body. Do your very best at nourishing your body, moving your body in ways that you enjoy. Definitely if you don't do resistance training, try it out. Because I tell you, there's nothing more fun than getting stronger. And there's a study that I actually just read about this where they, yeah, it's really interesting. But these women, so they did do resistance exercise with these postmenopausal women. I think it was a 12-week intervention, and they got stronger, but they didn't have an increase in lean tissue. Right? So the premenopausal women did. They got stronger and saw an increase in the lean body mass, but the postmenopausal women didn't. So that's again, if you're going to cycle back into measuring your success based on some lean body or some body composition testing, you're going to probably get frustrated. But if it's that, man, I used to bench 85 pounds and now I can bench 115 pounds or whatever that might be. I mean, for me, my husband jokes at me because I'll get up and jump up and down because, and I can, be stronger. It's fun. It can be fun. Or you might hate it to, you might not like it at all. And that's okay. Then let's do something different. But I think it's try it out, experiment, it might be something that feels good. And then you can just know that there is a benefit to that, right? Like you are keeping that muscle architecture strong, and there are really, really well-defined benefits to that intervention, no matter what happens with your body composition.
We talk about it all the time. And most people, I believe in our audience. Our audience is very positively responsive to strength training. So
Oh,
that message
good.
lands very well. I guess the last thing I'm curious about your thoughts on that kind of makes my head explode every time I hear it is calories in, calories out. Because it posits that we are like human bomb calorimeters and we're not.
Right. Yeah. What I always say is, oh my gosh, if it could be that easy, my life would be great. Like, I mean, I'm a math minor by background, so I am, very technical. I would love for the numbers to add up. And in my really, really early days, that's what we did. Like, this is the textbook that we get, is this idea that calories in equals calories out. But this idea that that is the way it is not true at all. I mean, yes, there is the basics of physics that, the energy we take in, gets burned appropriately and blah, blah, blah. But our bodies are brilliant. And so our bodies know to, if we're not taking in enough energy, let's call it calories, and for what other ever reasons, there's this constant dynamic back and forth between the body, where the body can become very efficient with the calories we take in. And it can be very efficient with the calories it's going to burn. And so a good friend of mine, Rebecca McConville, so I'm going to give her credit for this, but she uses this example when we think about it in terms of when we use the idea that energy balance is calories in equals calories out. And we're trying to help people understand that's not just how it works, is the idea of kind of how your financial strategies might be in your home. Right. So if you have certain bills that are essential bills you have to pay, right? You have your gas bill, your electric bill, your rent, you have these essential bills. And if you at the end of the month have spent extra money on something else, right? So if we think about that's exercise, right? Because our bodies are going to prioritize using the energy we take in to fuel that activity. And whatever is left over, then we can pay those bills. Well, if we don't have enough money to pay the electric bill or the gas bill, we're going to turn down the electricity. We're going to turn down the gas. So that's a similar metaphor for what our bodies do. At any age, if you are not taking in enough energy, it will turn down bone metabolism at a time when bone metabolism is already, breaking down more than it's building. It will turn down muscle building. It will turn down metabolic adaptations to your exercise. It will turn down digestion. And then there's individual variation. It's not true for everyone. So I work in a sports medicine clinic where I see a lot of women coming in with soft tissue injuries, bone stress injuries. I certainly see younger individuals with primary amenorrhea at age 18 or secondary amenorrhea as well at age 25. And those are the side effects of your body keeping you in balance. And so the reason it gets confusing is because someone will say, I'm not losing any weight though. I only eat 1200 calories a day. I don't lose any weight. In fact, I've gained weight. You're telling me I need to eat more? That doesn't make sense. But that's why your body has adjusted itself to be in homeostasis, to that equilibrium. And that's why we work with people to help you increase your intake and fill up those other essential body function buckets, if you will, so that your body can get back online. And then whatever, that body weight needs to be, that's where you have to start working on trusting your body with that.
Fascinating stuff. And as we've talked about throughout this whole thing, it is complex and there's still a lot that we need to learn. We being like research in general. I mean, there's so much we know a lot about physiology, but we're still learning all the time.
Absolutely. And that's especially in the menopause space because, as you're, I'm sure, very aware, if you really think about it, we only have a good 20 years worth of research into the physiology part because before that, you had really the WHI, WHI becoming kind of the catalyst for moving beyond empty nester syndrome as, how they're going to address, menopause. I mean, the stories back from the 60s and 70s are just horrendous in terms of how they were talking about menopause and how, it was this dreaded disease that needed to be fixed. But I see us cycling back into that, right? Because menopause is becoming so mainstream. And so supplement companies, marketers have to convince you that something's wrong and that there's something you need to fix. And to do that, it's a dreaded disease. It's this horrible thing. People are leaving their work. And it's just like, oh my gosh, there's many of us. I think it's some of the best years. I mean, I still have hot flashes and night sweats and I'm not sleeping great. And I would trade that any day for, worrying about whether I can wear white pants or not and all the cramps and all of the, I mean, I just happen to be a victim of a lot of PMS and migraines and things like that. So I just always want to get that message out there. I don't want to minimize someone who's having a rough transition. And at the same time, I want to offer this hope and this positive message that, hey, y'all, it can be some of your best years can lie ahead. We may have to do some body appreciation and some body acceptance and, dealing with the aging changes. But I think if you work on it, you can come into a space of feeling not so influenced by diet culture in that way.
Well, that's our show. Come on back next week when I sit down with the legendary ultra runner, Pam Reed. You are in for a real treat with her next week. I love this conversation. So come on back for that. And until then, as always, you know what to do. Stay feisty. You've been listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active performance-minded women. I'm your host, Celine Yeager. The show is edited and produced by the strong, talented, and amazing women at Live Feisty Media. Follow us on social media at Feisty Menopause. And please help us spread the word. Screenshot and share this episode on your social media channels with the tag at Feisty Menopause. Share the show with your friends. And please subscribe, like, review, and rate this show wherever you get your podcasts. Word of mouth and good reviews make it easier for other listeners to find. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay feisty.